Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. As if you needed any further proof, our show today demonstrates that you really can find music almost anywhere, from dumpsters to street corners to the depths of the ocean. Of course, the music in the deep blue sea tends not to be man-made. In fact, as we'll hear later, that music is in danger as human noise pollution affects the whales, whose songs have always crisscrossed the water. We'll also hear live music from England's Passenger, the one-man band that began busking on street corners and basically just moved on to bigger and better street corners. And as for the dumpsters, well, for that we have to bring back an old friend. Last time guitarist Nathan Salzberg was on the show, he was here to play songs from his album Affirmed, but today we've invited him back to wear another hat, that of folk music archivist. See, Nathan's day job is with the Alan Lomax Archive, and a few years ago, he stumbled on what might be his biggest find yet as an archivist. Piles and piles of early 20th century 78 RPM records. Some of them have been collected into a set called Work Hard, Play Hard, Pray Hard. Hard Time, Good Time, and End Time Music, 1923 to 1936. Nathan's on the line with us from Portland, Maine, and Nathan, that is a hell of a title.
Thanks very much. Yeah, you made your way through it pretty well. That title's been on my mind, actually, for a number of years. It just seemed, you know, it's a little cute, but I felt like it was would be potentially a really great set to put together of kind of tracing the life cycle of the rural Americans that made some of my favorite music, certainly country music. And my initial idea for the thing would be to draw from the collections at the American Folklife Center, the Library of Congress in D.C., but there's just so much stuff there. They say there are 120 years of 40-hour weeks worth of listening. I just sort of hung it up, and there it stayed until we discovered these records in my hometown of Louisville, Kentucky, and set this set a-rolling.
All right, now take us back to March 2010 in Louisville and stumbling onto this audio gold mine.
So the short story is that a friend of a friend of a friend in Louisville runs a dumpster company and basically brought a few boxes of 78s home that were on their way to the dumpster. And my friend, a fellow named Joe, saw the records, called me up, and said, there are some records here that might be to your taste. And, you know, it's old-timey stuff, which can really mean anything. It can mean Bing Crosby. It can mean Harry James. But I went to look at the records anyhow, and right away I knew it was a pretty serious collection. Some of the big names in country music for sure, Uncle Dave Macon, Jimmy Rogers, the Carter Family, but then some names that you don't see very often at all when you're digging for 78s. People like Alfred Carnes, who was a great singing evangelist from outside of Corbin, Kentucky.
I have heard of a land on a far away strand, 'tis a beautiful home of the soul, built by Jesus on high, there we never shall die, 'tis the land where we'll never grow.
A Mississippi John Hurt record, which is not representative of the collection because it's blues and this is 98% hillbilly, as they called it. But the John Hurt record just sent shivers down my spine. And we jumped in two cars and ran over to this dumpster on the other side of town and basically emptied it out. And that was only a quarter of the records. The next day, I called the dumpster boss first thing in the morning, went back over to the house and cleaned out the rest. And all told, there were about 2,800 78s.
2,800. And they belonged to a guy named Don Wall, who seems to have been, not really much other way to put this, a hoarder.
Indeed. We have called him a collector. I call him a collector. But there's no real evidence that he played these records.
Yeah.
Some of the records, he got them in. He was collecting between about 56 and the mid-60s, and then he started collecting LPs. Most of the LPs in his collection were sealed, and most of the 78s, they were in no kind of order whatsoever. There was no, certainly from an archival perspective, there was no finding aid. There was no organization, no rhyme or reason to his collecting. And there were a number of records that were still in their original mailers from the late 50s. Things were moldy as could be. Things were falling apart. The place was an absolute shambles. But he kept them, and they stayed in his house until he died, and his family apparently were estranged from him, and they directed the records to be thrown away.
So when you have records that are in that kind of shape, you write in the liner notes to this set about, picking things up and they're falling apart in your hand because they're so covered with mold and stuff. Are these old 78s durable enough that you could salvage a lot of them?
We salvaged most of them, absolutely. The fact is the 78s are really brittle if you drop them, but if you just lay them flat on, say, a record cleaner, which has a turntable built in, you can scrub to your heart's content until the mold comes off, which is really, really satisfying work. So we did basically all of the records. Some were broken in their boxes, but by and large, they've all been salvaged.
We're speaking with Nathan Salzberg. He's an archivist at the Alan Lomax Archive and a guitarist and composer. But with us talking about this this treasure of old 78s, you said 98% what people call hillbilly, early country, basically, is what we're talking about, right? Rural music of the Great Depression and the decade before?
That's right.
And so this set, Work Hard, Play Hard, Pray Hard, focuses on the time 1923 to 1936, and it is, as the title indicates, broken up into three sections. Let's talk about Work Hard first. Work songs, man, this is a long, long tradition in American music, in European music. We don't really hear a whole lot of work songs anymore, do we?
Certainly not. Usually the songs that we hear now are things to take our minds off work. Music that's made purely for entertainment purposes, which is not to say these records were not made for entertainment purposes, but in country music, people wore their occupations on their sleeves. They were truck drivers, or they were railroad section men, or they were longshoremen, or of course this works in both black and white music. But I think, in country music there's always been a great tradition of wearing your blue-collar roots.
Well, and trains are a kind of an enduring icon in American mythology and American music. And you have this song from 1930 by Red Gay and Jack Wellman called Flat Wheel Train Blues Part 2, which is like this amazing bit of musical onomatopoeia where the band is imitating the sounds of a train. We'll hear the sound of a mule braying.
This was one of those rare records that is, in fact, really rare, and also one that I had never heard before. It had never been reissued before in any LP or CD, and I'd never heard it. I put it on, and it was unlike anything I'd ever heard before, and I write this in the notes, that most of pre-war records, both black and white, that you hear doing train imitations, they're usually blown on harmonicas, but I've never heard one that actually is a train imitated by fiddle and guitar. So the thing was a novelty in itself musically, but then there's parts of it that I just find deeply affecting and melancholy, one of which is this bit with the mule.
This is Red Gay and Jack Wellman, the Flat Wheel Train Blues Part 2.
That's an awful steep hill ahead of us. Put in plenty of fire, son. Burn it down.
I got plenty of steam, buddy. Boy, this is some hill. Think you can make it?
I got it wide open.
See that old mule stand down there by the side of the track?
And every time we come by, this mule tries to outrun us. Holler too like that if you was to get left. Come on, let's make it up this hill.
That is Red Gay and Jack Wellman with the Flat Wheel Train Blues, Part 2, from 1930, recorded in November of that year in Atlanta, and now appearing on the set Work Hard, Play Hard, Pray Hard. Hard Time, Good Time, and End Time Music, 1923 to 1936, put together from this collection that my guest Nathan Salzberg found in and near, in a dumpster near, a home of a collector named Don Wall. So just to recap, Nathan, you had the idea for this set for a couple of years, and the sheer volume of stuff that was out there kind of kept you from pursuing the idea until this one distinct personal collection appeared in your life, right?
Exactly. And that's well said. I mean, I think that's the idea behind the set. Another element to the set, past sort of the thematic arrangement, for me was here was an opportunity to sort of memorialize this fellow that by all accounts had no friends, again, had an estranged family, and sort of erect a monument to his, I don't know, collecting tenacity or the extent of his hoarderness.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly, you know, for someone who's left no trace and almost left no trace at all, if his entire, you know, life's work collecting this stuff was in fact tossed out, I felt like the set was the best way to sort of give tribute to Don Wall.
And to people like him, because there are lots of other people out there who are, you know, genuine collectors and whose collections have made it possible for us to occasionally find these little gems. I mean, you mentioned that Red Gay and Jack Wellman song was something you were unaware of before this, right?
Absolutely. And there are records being discovered, not all the time, but, you know, every couple of years, one record that has been previously thought to have been lost to history turns up. There was a recent Blind Blake record, the last of the Blind Blake records that no one had ever heard, recently turned up at a flea market in Virginia just a few months ago. So they're still out there is the unspoken message here.
Play Hard is the second part of this three-part set. We're talking about 1923 to 1936, especially the second half of that time period. Not a carefree time, not a time we think of as very playful. Where do these songs, what kind of tradition do they come from?
Some of the music, you know, in the 30s, between 31 and 36, these records became rarer and rarer because the labels themselves were making fewer of them. People had less money to buy them with. Yet a lot of these records became more about, certainly about booze. When Prohibition was shot down, there was a lot of records came out, a number of records came out that sort of celebrated that.
In 1928 in Atlanta, Herschel Brown and His Boys recorded an example of one of these boozy songs. This one's called Corn Shuckin' Party in Georgia.
Well, here's the rest of the boys. Hello, boy.
Hi, boys. How are you?
Say, boys, you bring your instruments with you?
You bet.
Got them right in.
Now, boys, I got 10 1-gallon kegs of good charted corn liquor hid in that pile of corn. And as we shuck down to this here keg of liquor, while we'll drink it. Now, wait a minute. Don't start and grabble that corn all down here hunting for that liquor and get it strewed all over the yard. Now, before we start shucking, suppose we have a little tune. Where are you going to play, Centel?
Pass around the bottle and we'll all take a drink.
Hey, Centel.
Yeah.
You come on over here and lay down your violin and come on down here to the back of the barn. I got a keg of good liquor here down there.
Boy, you talking to me now. Let's go.
Well, here it is right here. Here it on this here bunch of farts.
Boy, that sure does look good.
Boy, ain't that pretty liquor?
Well, it's got a little bit of a sea shanty sound to it, Nathan, and also a kind of almost a comedic skit aspect to it.
This was a big deal for the labels in the late 1920s and early 30s, the hillbilly skit records. They called them rural dramas. They called them entertaining novelty records. And they started, actually, in 1927 with probably the biggest string band of the era, the Skillet Lickers, who made many, many dozens of records. They were from North Georgia. They had a huge hit with this 14-part thing called a Corn Liquor Still in Georgia. They sold, I think the first installment sold something like 100,000 records or more. This stuff, too, was a way of kind of having a virtual sniff in an era when you could only get away with illegal alcohol. So the fact that most of these records did pretty well was probably because people enjoyed the idea of sort of acting out a little bit against prohibition.
Again, the collection's called Work Hard, Play Hard, Pray Hard. We're in the Play Hard section right now. And you, Nathan, write this about the song we're about to hear. It is, quote, one of the first psychedelic freakouts ever put to record, unquote. This is Memphis 1929. What are you talking about?
I have no idea how Victor Records allowed this thing to be recorded and be released. We have no idea what it sold, but I can't imagine. Either it was a hit, though I imagine it wasn't, or it was just this absolute obscurity that, I mean, thank God it lasted. It has endured till now, because I heard this thing when I first dropped the needle. I couldn't believe my ears. I mean, it really is the weirdest thing I've ever heard. There were a lot of Fox Chase records made in this era, a lot of people sort of doing the Hounds and the Foxes, but nothing as weird or as intense or really downright as scary as this record.
This is Whit Gaydon and the Tennessee Coon Hunt. That is Whit Gaydon and Tennessee Coon Hunt, recorded September 17th, 1929 in Memphis. Nathan Salzberg has put together this collection, Work Hard, Play Hard, Pray Hard, Hard Time, Good Time, and End Time Music, 1923 to 1936. Can we assume, Nathan, that some sort of liquor was flowing in the recording session that day?
I'd like to, but at the same time, doing some research for the liner notes to this thing, I turned up some information about Whit Gaydon, primarily through his great-granddaughter, and he was actually a sort of a peripatetic poet. He wrote for a little newspaper in Albemarle, North Carolina, and he apparently wrote a poem for all 48 states, though none were ever published. I mean, he was an artist, so I don't know whether he was lit up when he recorded that, or this was just, again, a psychedelic expression.
Yeah, that's really interesting. All right, so let's wrap up with the Pray Hard part of the collection, which you mentioned singing evangelists before. How big a deal was this part of the music world back then?
This was a big part for both white and black music, both hillbilly and what they called race records. Of course, we know the more famous ones come from the race record catalogs, folks like Blind Willie Johnson, Washington Phillips, those sort of folks. But there were some really, really great real artists that were recorded in the late 20s and early 30s that were making evangelical songs, making religious pieces, recording religious pieces for the labels. And they were big sellers, too. I mean, some folks... maybe I imagine some people would only let records into their homes that were of a sacred nature, and the labels definitely capitalized on that. Some of the best were from my home state of Kentucky, a fellow named Ernest Phipps and His Holiness Singers, a fellow named Alfred G. Carnes, who's a famous one. They're on the set.
What about Snowball and Sunshine? This seems like yet another take on this tradition.
It is indeed, and it's kind of an anachronism. I would like to know what was actually thought or said in the recording booth when they made this record. Snowball and Sunshine were a husband and wife blackface team from Atlanta. They were white folks in blackface, and they did a weekly radio broadcast. At least Reverend Snowball did, the husband. His name was James Kimbrough. And he called it his Invisible Church of the Air. And he did sort of a black preacher spoof every week on the radio, and apparently it was popular. And he cut a record for Columbia in the late 1930. It was two parts of a sermon called Moses and the Bull Rush, in which, among other things, Mother Hubbard and Moses get rushed by a bull. so it was purely comic. But then they made this record in early 1931 for Columbia. They did a version of When the Saints Go Marching In. They did a version of Take Your Burden to the Lord and Leave It There. And I imagine that consumers of these records, especially in Atlanta or the South, maybe knew Snowball and Sunshine as being sort of a blackface, you know, parody act. But I don't hear that in this record at all, or just a very little. You sort of hear Reverend Snowball kind of goading his congregation on with some, you know, a little bit of dialect sort of, you know, stand up now. But the rest of it really sounds authentic to me. It sounds really sincere.
This is Snowball and Sunshine and Leave It There.
Take your burden to the Lord and leave it there.
Leave It There, recorded in Atlanta, 1931, by Snowball and Sunshine, who, as Nathan Salzberg was telling us, were husband and wife blackface parody duo. And that appears on the new set called Work Hard, Play Hard, Pray Hard. Hard Time, Good Time, and End Time music from 1923 to 1936. Nathan, did this collection tell you something new, shine a different light on that time period for you? Listening to these old hillbilly records, early kind of proto-country stuff, you know, is it more of the same stuff that collectors have heard for years, or was there something new, something unexpected here?
For me, this music's always been about the personalities that made it as much as it is about the social contexts or the collective traditions that the artist came from. And putting this thing together, I realized, you know, there were songs, there were great records or good records that would have fit the topics pretty well or to a T, that would have been great. But ultimately, I feel like these records are so, all of the ones that we put on the set are really just brimming with personality and with real artistry that I don't think is just sort of, a chip off the collective tradition, say, or the collective repertory. I feel like there's just sort of a rough and raggedness in the music pre-war that just, putting the thing together, it really struck me, and every record has that, and I think that's why I ended up including each one that I did.
There are 42 songs in this three-part set, Work Hard, Play Hard, Pray Hard, which also includes essays by J.J. Sullivan, Amanda Petrusich, and Sarah Bryan, put together by Nathan Salzberg, archivist at the Alan Lomax Archive. And thanks so much for sharing it with us on the program today.
Thanks so much, John. I really appreciate your interest.
This is Soundcheck. Coming up next, British busker turned YouTube celebrity Mike Rosenberg. He performs under the name Passenger, and he'll join us in the Soundcheck studio to tell his story and play live. This is Soundcheck.
You now just found her. Lord, I'm so drunk.
Shining in the dark, and they show us the way. One lights up every time you feel love in your heart. One dies when it moves away.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Until recently, the British busker turned troubadour Mike Rosenberg, who records under the name Passenger, was an unfamiliar name to most Americans, but that may be about to change. This year, the songwriter and guitarist received his first American release, had a song featured on the CBS show Elementary, and has now passed 3 million views on YouTube for his song Let Her Go, a song that he's going to play for us now here in the studio. This is Passenger, live on Soundcheck with Let Her Go.
Burning low, only miss the sun when it starts to snow, only know you love her when you let her go, only know you've been high when you're feeling low, only hate the road when you miss missing home. Only know you love her when you let her go. And you let her go. Staring at the bottom of your glass, hoping one day you'll make a dream last. Dreams come slow and go so fast. You see it when you close your eyes. Maybe one day you'll understand why everything you touch surely dies. But you only need the light when it's burning low. Only miss the sun when it starts to snow. Only know you love her when you let her go. Only know you've been high when you're feeling low. Only hate the road when you're missing home. Only know you love her when you let her go. You're staring at the ceiling in the dark. Same old empty feeling in your heart. Love comes slow and it goes so fast. Well, you see her when you fall asleep, but never to touch and never to keep, cause you loved her too much and dive too deep. Well, you only need the light when it's burning low. Only miss the sun when it starts to snow. Only know you love her when you let her go. You've been high when you're feeling low. Only hate the road when you're missing home. Only know you love her when you let her go. You only need the light when it's burning low. Only miss the sun when it starts to snow. Only know you love her when you let her go. Only know you've been high when you're feeling low. Only hate the road when you're missing home. Only know you love her when you let her go. And you let her go.
That is Passenger and his song Let Her Go. 3 million views on YouTube and counting. Mike, first of all, welcome to Soundcheck.
Thank you so much.
Did you see that one coming?
Absolutely not. No, it was. It's all been pretty crazy the last couple of months. Yeah, as you said, you know, I've been busking and doing everything independently and very sort of DIY. So for a song to suddenly do so well and get so big, it's quite a bizarre feeling.
Yeah. Now, you use the name Passenger. So who's driving this vehicle?
That's a good question. Yeah. I guess I am. Passenger came about, because it used to be a band,
right.
a five piece, a few years ago. And we were searching for a band name for months and months. And, eventually I wrote a song called Passenger, and it just seemed to work with the sort of observational style of lyrics. Almost like, you know, you're a passenger and you're watching the world go by and, you know, you're just picking out characters and stories as you go.
So the line, you know, you only hate the road when you're missing home. You've done a lot of traveling, you know, busking in the UK and Australia, back and forth. Do you miss home? Is there a home to miss?
Yeah, no, of course I do. I mean, my folks are still back in England and obviously a lot of my good friends and my sister and stuff. So I definitely miss home. After so long of being on the road, it you do get used to it, you know. You kind of forget that that's even an option, actually. You become quite detached from the idea of home, really.
So do you have a fixed address right now?
If I need something posted, I give my parents' address.
Okay.
But yeah, so, I definitely think of that as home. But yes, not my own place.
Yeah. So how different has it been for you these last couple of months, going from busking, which is a very intimate DIY form of music making, as you say, to, you know, playing big stages, opening for Ed Sheeran, who, you know, just had a Grammy nomination for Song of the Year.
I know.
So, you know.
I know. I saw him last night, and it was it's pretty big, even for him, which, you know, he's enormous now, but I think even for him, that's pretty big news.
Yeah. But so it's like a different kind of, it's a different life cycle for a musician, you know, going from busking to playing those sorts of stages, isn't it?
It really is, yeah. I mean, I've been touring with Ed for about 3 months, and yeah, you know, every night it's playing to between 2,000 and 5,000 people, which is completely the opposite of setting up on some street corner and playing to
whoever's,
you know,
walking
whoever,
by,
yeah, whoever fancies listening. You know, it's a very different mindset. You know, it's and it is odd to jump from one to the other so quickly.
Mm-hmm.
But I think I'm very cautious of the fact that I love busking, and I love the honest and direct approach. You know, and I think in this day and age of X Factor and smoke and smoke machines and mirrors and whatever, it's really refreshing to people to just kind of stumble across something in the street, which is, there's no gimmicks, there's no rubbish, you know.
Right,
it's just
right.
Songs, you know.
You don't have a celebrity judge standing over you, and
no, exactly.
You don't have some, you know, star of the 70s or 80s giving you tips on how to sing his or her songs.
Exactly, yeah. Although I could probably use them. But
you've made your feelings about shows like The X Factor known in one of your songs, which is called I Hate.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
You know, it's
subtle, you know, it's a subtle message, yeah. I don't know, man. Like, I think each to their own. I certainly don't begrudge people who go on those shows. Mm-hmm. It's more the setup. And the people that run them, actually. And I don't know. I don't want to make a big thing of it.
Not for you, though.
Yeah.
We're speaking with Passenger, a.k.a. Mike Rosenberg, who has a series of records in the U.K., but this one, All the Little Lights, this is your first here in the States. As someone who's used to playing guy and guitar on a street corner or subway station, whatever, when you get into the studio, do you have, you know, are you thinking, gosh, I need to, you know, I can't layer too much on here because it needs to be the song when I go back out on the road and play it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I've made, I think I've made 5 records now, and the majority of those albums have just been me in a room playing a song. And then, you know, you might add like a backing vocal or a violin or something like that, but
right.
Keeping it very sparse. And that's how I love my music, you know. That's how I like to play it. That's how I like to listen to it, you know, very simple and generally, you know.
Where does that come from? What did you listen to growing up?
My dad's originally from the States. He's from New Jersey, actually. And so he, from a very young age, I remember listening to sort of Paul Simon and Bob Dylan and James Taylor and loads of sort of old American singer-songwriters.
Mm-hmm.
So that's really my sort of bread and butter, really. But yeah, with this record, it just felt to me that the songs demanded a slightly bigger arrangement. You know, they could cope with a rhythm section and a string section and whatever else. So I think it's important, you know, not to just keep on making the same record over and over again. Like every time I go into the studio, I want to do something challenging and something different. And it may work, it may not. But I think that's a really important part of being an artist, is to keep on challenging yourself and the listener as well.
So Passenger's new album is called All the Little Lights, his first here in the States. Here's another solo performance. This one's called Feather on a Clyde.
There's a river that runs through Glasgow. It makes her, but it breaks her and takes her in two parts. And a current just like my blood flows down from the hills, round aching bones, to my restless heart. Well, I'd swim, but the river is so wide. I'm scared I won't make it to the other side. Well, God knows I failed, but he knows that I've tried. I long for something that's safe and warm, but all I have is all that is gone. I'm as helpless and as hopeless as a feather on the cloud. Inside all the lights glow, and the folks go and the kids know where the music and the drinking starts. On the other side where no cars go, up to the hills that stand alone like my restless heart. I would swim, but the river is so wide, and I'm scared I won't make it to the other side. Well, God knows I've failed, but he knows that I've tried. I long for something that's safe and warm, but all I have is all that is gone. I'm as helpless and as hopeless as a feather on the cloud. Where the sun sets late in Glasgow, and the daylight in the city part. And I think of you in Glasgow, 'cause you're all the safe, you're all the warm. In my restless heart.
That is Passenger and his song Feather on the Clyde, a song about the River Clyde, which flows through the Scottish town of Glasgow. Strangely, that's a song that featured in the CBS show Elementary, their Sherlock Holmes show,
yeah.
Mike. Have you seen the episode?
I did. I saw the little snippet where it's in, and I think it works really well. It doesn't mention Glasgow too much in the snippet that they've used.
Okay.
But, yeah, it's, you know, it's all part of this crazy few months that I've had, you know. It's, you know.
Well, there's crazy, and then there's, like, serious crazy. A fan apparently liked your song Bullets.
Yeah.
And sent you a present in the mail.
She actually gave it to me in person.
Gave it to you in person. A bullet.
A live bullet. and she'd like, you know, written stuff on it. And it was really, really lovely, really sweet and thoughtful gift.
I'll take your word for it.
Yes, yeah, it sounds a bit odd. But I put it in my bag. Not thinking about it, I checked my bag in when I was flying from Berlin to Munich last week. And I was just sitting there minding my own business, reading the paper. And two pretty enormous German police officers came up to me and asked if I'd come with them. So I did. And they told me that they'd found firearms in my bag. And I didn't know what they were talking about. And I immediately thought someone had put a gun in my bag, you know, without me knowing. So I just started panicking, like, you know, this is the end of my musical career and free life. You know, I'm going to go to prison in Berlin. This is dreadful. But eventually they called it a bullet, and I finally clicked what had happened. And I told them, and I think they thought it was so ridiculous that I couldn't have made it up. You know?
Could not. This guy could not possibly be lying.
Exactly. Yeah.
So where is the bullet now?
I think they took it.
Yeah.
Which I was happy about, actually. I don't think I could be trusted with such objects.
The album is called All the Little Lights. It's the latest from Passenger and the first of his records to be available here in the States. Mike, it's been a real pleasure having you with us on the show today. Thanks so much.
It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you.
This is Soundcheck.
And I hate pointless status updates on Facebook. FYI, we were never M8s. We pretend to be friends on the internet when in real life we have nothing to say.
Good news, you can find another live performance from Passenger as well as a video from his session here in the studio on our website, soundcheck.org.
I have love to give, but sometimes all you can do is hate. And it goes a la 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 la, 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 a la 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 la. La 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 la, la 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 la.
Now it's time to give you just a taste of the latest installment of our web video series, Tough Critics. It features three of the most brutally honest people we know: Elizabeth, Onaje, and Will. They're all fifth graders, and they're not afraid to tell it like they hear it. Recently, we brought them one of R&B singer Brandy's new tracks off of her new record, 211. The song is called Wildest Dreams. Let's hear a bit of what they had to say.
I'm gonna sing that song that's really like in right now. It's kind of more like a lovish song thing, and it's slow, and the kind of songs that are in right now are not as slow, they're kind of more fast paced.
If it was just without the lyrics, it would be like a really good just like listening to running song. Just that. Just Brandy, it
seemed I had it all. So young, yet so wise. You can watch the entire video and check out the whole Tough Critic series on our website, soundcheck.org. Up next, hard to believe, but noise pollution is becoming a serious problem in the ocean. We'll learn more from a sound mapping scientist next on Soundcheck.
Under the sea, darling, it's better down where it's wetter. Take it from me.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Sorry to burst your bubble, but it actually doesn't sound like this under the sea.
I'm floating under the sea.
Of course, there is quite a bit of singing going on. Whales and dolphins vocalize underwater all the time. But these days, our oceans also contain a lot of loud, human-made sounds, like this. Dr. Leela Hatch co-directs a government-led project to map those sounds, and she joins me now by phone from the coast of Massachusetts. Leela, welcome to Soundcheck.
Thank you very much.
We hear about noise pollution on land, especially in urban environments, all the time. Is a similar thing now happening underwater?
It is, and we are starting to understand it in some of the same ways. We've been thinking about the experience of living near a busy airport or in a downtown metropolitan area. Underwater, sound travels extremely efficiently, and it keeps the acoustic energy for really large areas, and this can produce real problems chronically for animals.
So in other words, a noise that's loud 6 feet under the water will still be loud a considerable distance away under the water.
Particularly those low-frequency sounds that are made, those low tones on the piano, those are the ones that propagate those long wavelengths extremely efficiently underwater. Higher-frequency sounds lose their energy over relatively short distances, but those longer frequencies, especially in the right conditions of temperature and pressure in the ocean, can travel hundreds of thousands of miles.
Really?
Yes.
Well, I mean, the Earth is only, what, 25,000 miles in circumference? That means that sound can, like, travel under the ocean sort of indefinitely?
Well, it does mean that there are conditions that have been theorized and in a few empirical cases actually backed up of sounds being able to travel pole to pole. These sounds are below our range of human hearing, but they're produced by blue whales and fin whales, the largest animals in the world, and there are conditions under which they are able to make vocalizations that in special temperature and pressure regimes called the low-frequency sound channel can travel these great, great distances.
Wow. We've actually got a sound clip of blue whales, and as Dr. Hatch just told us, they generally make sounds way too low for humans to hear, but this recording from the website Discovery of Sound in the Sea has been sped up by a factor of 10, which raises the pitch enough for human ears to hear. So with man-made sounds, you mentioned the lower notes of the piano. Nobody's playing pianos underwater, but we do have boats, obviously. We've got, you know, oil rigs and drilling and stuff. So are those low-frequency sounds, are they the real problem?
They are in the types of things that we were focused on in this project. They're are a variety of things that humans do purposefully to using sound, some of them mimicking a lot of the same things that marine animals are trying to get done out there, communicate with one another over very vast distances, understand the topography and navigate. Those are all things that we've been mimicking for a very long time in our use of sound, purposeful use of sound.
You're talking about things like sonar.
Things like sonars, exactly, and things like air guns, which are explosive sounds we make to image the benthic seafloor and understand where oil and gas deposits are. We're using that more and more prolifically.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are the incidental sounds we make, and that is we're doing something else, and as a byproduct, we're producing noise. And the one we've been very focused on there is the cavitation produced by the propellers of large commercial ships.
Now, when you say cavitation, is that the motion of the rotary motion of the water?
That's exactly right. When we move a propeller of these very large vessels through the water, it produces bubbles that trail off of the propeller tips. And when those bubbles burst or cavitate, they produce a low-frequency sound signature that really overlaps strongly the vocal ranges and the hearing ranges of many marine mammals.
So this is, let's give listeners a chance to hear what we're talking about. This is a recording of a large commercial ship. This boat is 2 miles away from the microphone picking up the sound. So that's the sound of a large commercial ship recorded underwater 2 miles away. And as Dr. Leela Hatch has been telling us, part of the problem with sound underwater is it does propagate really efficiently. Dr. Leela Hatch is a marine biologist for the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration and is co-directing this project to map underwater sounds. Leela, are you finding that these sounds tend, I mean, I guess with the way sound blooms underwater, even if everything's contained in a shipping lane, it's going to sort of spread, isn't it?
That's exactly, there's a very good characteristics to note. So you're going to have the experience you have when you stand near a hideaway and you have the peaks and the troughs of traffic passing you, right? You have the loud sound as the car approaches, and then you have it diminishing as it goes by. But also you know that if you live behind a fence near that highway, that the sound really is never overall diminished. And in the ocean, you have that same condition near a shipping lane, but then it's also amplified by scale.
Mm.
So we're moving over 98% of the world's stuff now by ship. It's a really our main mechanism for transporting goods. This means a really large growth in container ship traffic. And accompanying that has been a really large growth in the amount of noise going into the ocean from ships. And it's a ubiquitous hum.
Mm. So
over very great distances.
So it's not restricted to shipping lanes.
No, it's not.
Now, having grown up, Leila, here in New York City, near an elevated subway line, mm-hmm. I know that after a while, you sort of get conditioned to it, and you learn to live with it and maybe even not hear it. But the animals we're talking about, the sea mammals, dolphins, porpoises, and especially whales, are they able to sort of recondition themselves that way, or are you seeing evidence of hearing loss and ability to communicate? What's happening?
Well, I think the first answer to your question, to be very blunt, is that we don't know. We are just starting to understand what this means, this sort of ubiquitous growth of noise means for these marine animals. We don't actually know anything about whether humans or animals stop having a stress response in conditions of high noise. We need to learn a lot more before we understand what's going on with them and how they might be able to carry this load amongst the other stressors that they're encountering in the marine environment.
We're speaking with Dr. Leila Hatch, marine biologist for the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, in this mapping project to look at where sound is becoming a real problem underwater. So then, as you map where the sounds are in the ocean, where are you finding the biggest concentrations of problems, of low sounds, of high sounds?
Well, I mean, you're getting closer to how you might apply this to a management question in some ways by asking the question, where are the problems? The problems to us kind of implies where would you focus your attention.
Right.
But the first stage of the problem is first maybe just where's reddest? Where are the loudest spots? And that's the phase we've been at working at first, which is just the documenting stage. And we've been finding, not too surprisingly, that our coastal regions and our ports are quite loud. The I-95 corridor, translates to a corridor off of the East Coast that has a pretty loud conditions on average, in an annual average way of looking at things. The Gulf of Mexico, due to its many forms of human activity, is sort of a heavily urbanized acoustic environment, as are several areas of the U.S. West Coast.
So what do you do? I mean, once you get past documenting and into managing, what's your hope?
Well, there are a few things. I mean, you start to ask questions about where might we target our concerns in terms of how this overlaps with the distribution and density of animals. That's a parallel effort to the sound mapping effort, was an effort to coalesce and make more accessible what NOAA and its partners know about where whales and dolphins are in the world's ocean, where the hotspots and the sort of the important descriptors of where they are and how they use the ocean environment. And so now we're working to integrate that information in a way that can help us ask the question, where are the priority areas to manage? But then also you can go to those noise producers, and in particular groups that have a real interest in decreasing their noise signature. They're not making it purposefully, like ships. And you can start to work on technical mechanisms to reduce the amount of noise that they're putting into the water column.
Well, it's a big project, and Leila, certainly wish you the best of luck with it. Dr. Leila Hatch is a marine biologist for NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, and co-directing this project to map the sound pollution in the oceans. Leila, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
This is Soundcheck. To wrap up our show today, I want to ask you a question. This Thursday, we'll be talking about so-called musical moments, those magical little passages in a song that just reach out and grab you. Has that happened to you? Not a whole piece of music, not a whole song, but just a couple of notes, a turn of a musical phrase, a passing echo of a melody. We'll be talking with the New York Times classical music critic Anthony Tomasini and the neuroscientist Daniel Levitin about this topic, and we'd like to hear from you. Tell us about your magical musical moment. Leave us a message at 866-939-1612 or send us an email, soundcheck@wnyc.org. Again, that number, 866-939-1612, or email soundcheck@wnyc.org. That's going to do it for our show today. Coming up tomorrow at 9, blues singer Valerie June stops by to sing a couple of songs. Her debut studio album won't be released till next year, but her unique voice and guitar skills have already generated a lot of buzz. Plus, musician and composer Everett Bradley brings us Holodelic. A funk holiday spectacular that's a lot closer to George Clinton's Parliament than it is to Perry Como. All of that tomorrow on Soundcheck. Till then, I'll see you online at soundcheck.org. I'm John Schaefer.